since 2018, we've been looking to invest into Eastern Europe. I've been coming to Budapest, Bucharest, Sofia, Athens, etc. There's been, like, I think, 10 companies that are going to either become unicorns or are soon unicorns on the way to become unicorns, and we invested in none of them. And one of them was you. But we did want to invest. It was just that there was the accelerator. You didn't want the accelerator. I remember having that discussion with you, like, yeah, 4 years ago.
Yeah, well, yeah, first, hi all. Yes, if I recall correctly, we did talk.
We did talk. No, I was interested.
Yeah, I think, actually, we have been accepted to a couple of accelerators, but then we were already too late, so we thought that to give up that certain amount of equity doesn't make sense anymore. But yeah, we've heard great things. Is Marvin also here?
No, he's not here. He left, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, he did. Oh. He did. Great, still a great guy.
Yeah.
He will be at Untold.
When is that?
When is that?
End of November.
Oh. I'm there. Anyways, let's jump into it. Siom was your first job right after college.
Indeed.
How did that come about?
Yeah, so the whole story came from a university project with my co-founder, Benza. We were working on a crypto exchange. And
Which year was this, working on a crypto exchange?
2016.
It's early. Yeah. I think after 2018, if you were doing a crypto exchange, come on, I mean, it's too late. 2016, it's good.
Yeah, well, we've thought about this the first time, 2012. But then, you know, like, opportunity wasn't there. But later we came to the conclusion to launch one, and we failed because of fraud.
But in makes sense. But in a lot of these parallel universes, you were rich. If you continued with crypto exchange, how did you detect the fraud problem in the crypto exchange?
Well, we have started our own investigation, and then realized that there are no good solution on the market available for us as a very early stage business. So we decided to build our own in-house tool and then later pivoted to Siom.
And trying to do a fraud detection company while you're very, very young probably raised a lot of eyebrows on a lot of people. Did you see any advantages or disadvantages of being so young and going into such a legacy, old-fashioned industry where people need to take you seriously, but then again, you're too young? How did that feel?
Yeah, I think it's really a double-edged sword. So some investors really like young and talented, hopefully we are. some of them actually would rather invest in a young co-founder team. Some of them actually prefer second-time founders or serial entrepreneurs. And obviously, on the actual knowledge side, we had to actually have a few years experience to find the product market fit and learn more about key players in the industry. So yeah, it took some time actually to get on speed and find the product market fit. But nevertheless, I think better sooner than later or never.
So you built the domain expertise along the way. When you started, you didn't have the domain expertise, but 3 years down the line, you had all the expertise, right?
Yeah, I would say, well, this is something you always have to learn more about. So it's a continuously evolving industry, because I would summarize it as a cat and mouse game. So fraudsters are getting smarter. You have to get smarter. You have to improve the algorithm, the capability of the tool. So it does take some time. But I would say our advantage really was a specific feature set we have launched, and then it could help to actually be more efficient in fighting fraud.
And you said this is a cat and mouse game. Can you give some examples of that, like more concrete examples of how cat is winning and then mouse starts winning and then, oh shit, cat is winning again?
Yeah, if some of our customer success team would be here, they could tell a lot of stories, but really, like, people mainly trying to pay with stolen card details or with stolen passwords. And obviously, as soon as we adopt to some new techniques, then they try to get smart. They try to reverse engineer our own tools to try to get around our rules. And then we have to adapt to all these new ways and then, you know, find the patterns and match with them and just get smarter.
fun. It's like fraudsters never sleep. It's like money never sleeps, fraudster never sleep.
They are all around the world, so yeah.
All around us.
You never know.
And what does Sion do? Can you explain what Sion does? Can you tell a bit about the platform and the technology behind it?
Sure. It's an API-based platform. So we connect to other businesses. We are usually integrated to their sign-up flow or payment. And what they send to us is a number of data points, such as email address, phone number. We collect the customer's device details, also their IP address. We enrich the data from publicly available open sources. And then we use machine learning to score the transactions and tell our clients how suspicious they could be.
And this is a very hyper-competitive and old industry. As you can realize, the industry started even before there was online anything, online e-commerce or payments. It started with payments. But I think this is an ever-evolving space where there are windows opening and closing, and if you can leverage a couple of those windows, you would be big enough. What openings did you realize there are, and how the legacy players were not able to address it, and what made you think that you can address those openings?
So I think when we actually first time faced the fraudulent transactions ourselves, we have obviously investigated the type of tracks we can see, and we saw that actually these customers are using brand new email addresses, and as well as maybe some form of a proxy like VPN or Tor connection to hide their own IP address. They might use some form of automation or bots to access the sites. So really what we could do is build a set of tools and then offer them as microservices to our clients. And I think what we have been also quite successful with is the product-led growth strategy. So we offered a free trial. We still have transparent pricing. We put everything on the site from the product details to the API reference. So we really made it easy to let our clients to sample the tool, find their ROI, and then become a paying customers of ours.
Yeah, to me, it seems like there were three macro trends, big trends that led to the success. A, obviously, explosion of data. B, you can now build machine learning on top of it. And then C, you can package all of that on a microservices fashion rather than trying to sell the intent product and change the product stack that, say, a fintech company has. You can give it as microservices. Would you agree with those three pillars that led to success?
Yeah, definitely. And our job is a bit harder than only developer-led tools because we have to convince multiple stakeholders in a buying process. So we are also selling to chief risk officers or head of risk or trust and safety, but as well as we have to convince the engineers, obviously the CFO, like every other SaaS provider has to do that, but a number of stakeholders in the process usually.
And do you see legacy players adapting a similar strategy? Do you see legacy players adapting social data points to enrich the data that you can get from a transaction, build machine learning on top of it, and then even maybe package it on a microservices-based API-first approach? Do you see them moving towards there after your success?
Not really that much as I would have expected or would expect. I think we have an advantage just by being an early mover. And then what we are doing also is continuously increasing the number of checks we do. So even if someone has started to actually develop the tool set we had half a year ago, then a year from now, we would already be far ahead.
And you also said that two different differentiations that you have, one of them was the product-led growth, another one was the transparent pricing strategy, and I guess the third one was the API-first approach. Did that change the customer persona you were targeting when you compare yourself to the legacy players? Being able to do transparent pricing, product-led growth, and an API-first approach seems to position you on a different spectrum on the customer base where no other one is looking into.
Yeah, obviously. So during the pandemic, we have seen an increased adoption of digital services and products. So I think we had a big advantage just by being very open about everything. And we didn't really force the clients to jump on numerous of discovery and sales calls and then force them to just provide data about their business to set up a quotation and tailor, the whole offering to actually like how big of a customer they are. We had everything on our website and then we actually scaled up during the pandemic. So because no one really could fly to meet clients and there were no conferences to have those face-to-face meetings where those enterprises, salespeople could convince potential buyers to buy software. We actually just put everything on the website and, you know, did what we have started to actually do 2 years before. And then it was a huge boost to us because then every buyer was only capable of looking at tools online, do their own research and look at comparison websites to see how different solutions are stacked to each other.
And apart from the product-led growth strategy, what other sales or marketing strategy you guys have?
I think, what we have been fairly successful with is the content strategy. So still today, over 70% of our leads are inbound. They find us through Google, so SEO-related searches. And we were very proactive of actually setting up a small media team within our own organization. So we produce a lot of different type of content, such as blog posts, case studies, ebooks, guides, and everything is more of this do-it-yourself style. So we don't really sell Sion, or we don't try to put them in their face, but we try to explain a solution to their problem. And this is what also HubSpot was very successful at. So we try to be more of them compared to a Salesforce.
And what happens after that? What happens after content? Let's say you did a bunch of content, I signed up to your newsletter or somehow gave my email address. What happens after that in your funnel?
So it depends on, if you seem like one of our ICP, then we might reach out to you through our BDR teammates, or we might put you in one of our nutrition flow. It really depends on your, you know, how many times you came back to the site. So again, we use HubSpot as our CRM. We have a lot of automation in place, but I would say now we try to even channel more clients through the self sign-up flow, because we have realized that even the human element can be a bottleneck during the onboarding process. So again, we try to automate the onboarding for our own tool as well.
And where do you stand today from a traction perspective? How many transactions, fraudsters, customers, MRR?
Oh yeah, well, we grew 3 times in 2020 in terms of ARR, so revenue. Again, last year 3 times. Hopefully it will be close to 3x again this year. And in terms of what metrics are you interested in, mainly?
For example, is this growth driven by new customers or upselling to existing customers?
So last 2 years was really successful because of our high NDR number, which was close to 200%.
NDR is net dollar retention, and what it means is, I'm having fun. NDR is net dollar retention, and what it means is, let's say you have 100 customers paying $100 for you this year. Next year, you might have 90 customers, but those 90 customers might be paying $120 to you. So you're growing within your customer base, and almost all of the public SaaS companies have more than 100% net dollar retention, which means if they kick off, if they fire all of their sales teams, they're going to continue to grow within their existing customers.
Yeah, so we have seen a lot of growth from existing accounts. And this year, obviously, because of the macro, it hasn't been so high, but still it's above average. And then, happy to share any other insights.
And how does the unit economics look like?
Which unit
economics? LTV over CAC for you?
9 to 1. Right.
9 to 1.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
You're giving a lot of data points. I'm loving it. What about the payback period?
11 months.
11 months.
But
that's good.
I think
healthy.
Our CFO is in the back. Maybe he can correct me. Maybe he left, but he was there. So I think, 11 months now. Mm-hmm.
Nice. And the breakdown of if you were to dissect the customers into no-touch customers, that would be the long-tail people buying and not paying that much, and then a bit more high-touch customers where you would be selling through the inside sales team or face-to-face. What's the breakdown of the customer base from that perspective?
Actually, it's interesting because we see the weird ratios. So we have a lot of long-tail, a lot of enterprise, some mid-market, but since what we do is really industry agnostic, so any online business can use our tool, small, medium, large, and you know, because of the minimum tiers are very low. We're actually also launching a freemium very soon, so we're going to see probably more long-tail customers. We also have a Shopify app, so we see increasing traction also from that project. And ratios-wise, I'm not exactly sure, but our ACV is around 50,000, so not too bad. But
what's the growth in the ACV? I'm pretty sure over the past 4 years, your ACV grew probably like by 5x.
No, it's weird because actually it's not the case since we are, as well as, you know, we are, our number of customers are growing, but as well as some smaller and not as many large clients are coming in as like percentage-wise before. So actually ACV is lowering, but it's not bad because our customer pool is growing.
It's growing too fast. Last question on metrics. A company like Sion must have amazing churn rates, like probably close to 0% customer count churn rates. Mm-hmm. Nice. Amazing.
Our product works, so I guess they don't want to leave us. But yeah, sometimes our investors are asking, you know, like, hey, you know, maybe it's a problem with the product if you're not growing fast enough. And I think churn is your answer to that question. So if you don't have churn, then probably it's the GTM strategy, which might be not the most optimal.
And what's the geo breakdown of the customers?
Yeah, we are the most dominant in Europe. So I think 40%, then APAC, about 20%, LATAM, 15%. And the rest is US and rest of the world. So we are the smallest in United States. But then that's why Ben, my co-founder, has just relocated to Austin, where we have the office, to actually scale up from there.
It's interesting because the US enterprise software market is almost larger than the rest of the world combined, 50%. Excluding China. It's like largest than all of the world combined, but then it's only 10-15% of your customer base.
Exactly. So we, as a European company, had the first mover advantage here. And we actually, I think, were quite successful in getting some chunk of the market. But then in the US, it's just much more competitive. And it's way more challenging to actually hire people, especially if you are a European company without an HQ. And you have to spend much more money, and you have to increase your brand awareness crazily to actually find some interested candidates. So that's a really big challenge, and we are trying to tackle it right now.
Can you give more examples of that? Because I also believe that obviously you need to launch an office in the US to be present there. That helps from a revenue perspective, fundraising perspective, down the line M&A or an IPO. I mean, the value chain for enterprise software is still in the US. But then again, you can't do that remotely from here, try to hire top tier people. How was your experience? What happened? For how long have you been trying to ramp that up? And then the last, I guess, thing on the equation was, you know what, your co-founder needs to move to make it happen. What else have you tried?
Yeah, I think we should have done that before. So that's my lack of experience, which might what I'm gaining right now, or what we are gaining all together. So I think you should have a minimum deployable unit in every location, every new office, which might include BDRs, SDRs, BDM, CS, and you know DevOps, everything that's needed to cover the time zone. And we have been taking like baby steps and you know hiring and firing people, so one step ahead, one step back. And yeah, you know, we had an office, we had to move to a new office, it was too small. Then, you know, it's renting an office is easy, it's more really the challenge is to find people because no one is applying for your jobs in the US. So you have to find headhunters who might, you know, not be great, or if they do some work, you see way more rejection because they have offers from Apple, Google, Facebook, Indeed, from every company. We are in Austin, and all these companies are presented there as well.
Yeah. And why Austin?
So we have been researching, you know, the different potential locations. So we wanted to be on the East Coast to be closer in terms of time zones. It's only 7 hours from here. And West Coast is really hard. Yeah. So it's 9 hours. So when you wake up in the Silicon Valley, then it's already after working hours in Europe, especially in Hungary. And then we've heard that in Austin they have the best inside salespeople because some large companies have like deal this kind of teams located there, and yeah, it seemed like a cool place. We went there, we liked barbecue, so.
Yeah, I like it. I went there in South by Southwest. Amazing. It was like spring break for people who are 30, 40 years old. It was great.
Yeah.
And you took a lot of time to build the product initially after you started. For years, you built the product. People say success comes slowly and then all at once. And that is what happened with you guys as well. After the product matured, there was an inflection point, and then came traction, fundraising momentum, hypergrowth, blitzscaling. What was that initial early sign of product market fit that kind of told you this product has stickiness, now it's time to aggressively push?
I think when we had the first few international clients, when not only early adopters slash beta testers were our users, so we saw some form of traction. And then this led to us to actually do more targeted outreach to find more of those type of clients, which was mainly the iGaming space, so online casinos, gambling, iGaming, etc. And now we cover the whole market with our product, but as well as we had to look into way more markets.
And going again back to the customer breakdown, from an industry perspective, how did that change? Moving from casinos, et cetera, into potentially financial services, did you see that breakdown evolve?
Yeah, sure. So now iGaming is less than 20%. I think 40% is fintech, so Revolut, Wise, Nubank, Afterpay. We've got also a number of e-commerce, including airlines or travel companies, about 20%, and the biggest portion, about 30%, is just a mix of 15 different industries. So we have crypto platforms, trading companies, a lot of different online businesses.
When is the IPO?
Not this year. We will wait.
Illegal to IPO this year.
Yeah, no one does that. Even sounds weird to talk about that. But I think, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, we just raised this round this year, so we have to make those bold bets we wanted to do and what we raised the capital for. I would say it's not on the horizon right now, and it's too early to talk about it, but maybe, you know, like in 4 or 5 years' time, if something would change, and hopefully things will change.
And what's, last question, what's one big bold bet that you're taking as a company that's probably going to fail, but if it sticks, it's going to go big time?
That's a good question. I would say we are acquiring a business, and this is very interesting because we haven't done it before.
That's the riskiest thing to acquire companies.
Yeah. And I hope it will work out. And my hopes are up, and we are eager to see even more of that type of acquisitions to actually find those shortcuts to deliver new product lines even in a faster way. So I think it's a good strategy to follow through.
Product acquisition. You're buying a company who built a product. You're going to sustain the team to continue building onto the product, which will be your suit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks a lot for joining.
My this pleasure. Thank you.
To stay in the loop, go to our website, getcc.com, or follow us at getcc on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.